Moving to agenda paper 7.
Agenda paper 7 is about how an entity applies IFRS 9 when a credit impaired financial asset is subsequently paid in full or is no longer credit impaired. And this is what the submitter refers to as curing. So when a financial asset becomes credit impaired, based on the requirements of IFRS 9, interest revenue is calculated by applying the effective interest rate to the amortized cost and not the gross carrying amount in subsequent reporting periods. In this paper, we use the term unrecognized interest to mean the difference between the interest calculated by applying the effective interest rate to the gross carrying amount and the amount of interest income recognized for credit-impaired financial assets. Specifically, the request asked whether an entity can present this difference as interest revenue in profit or loss when the asset cures. The main facts of the submission are presented using an illustrative example in paragraphs 10 to 25 of the paper. The relevant requirements of IFRS 9 are described in paragraphs 28 to 33 of the paper. Based on these requirements, the gross carrying amount, the amortized cost, and the expected credit loss allowance are all discounted amounts. In paragraphs 34 to 41, we first analyze the presentation of unrecognized interest during the period that the financial asset is credit impaired. Then in paragraphs 42 to 44, we analyze the reversal of unrecognized interest upon curing. Based on paragraph 558 of IFRS 9, an entity recognizes in profit or loss as an impairment gain or loss amounts required to adjust the loss allowance at the reporting date to the amount that is required to be recognized in accordance with IFRS 9. So accordingly, when the financial asset cures, an entity reverses the expected credit losses on the financial asset through the credit impairment line because it's also an adjustment to bring the loss allowance to at the reporting date to the amount that is required to be recognized applying IFRS 9, which is zero if the credit impaired asset cures fully. The staff's analysis demonstrates that this is consistent with the definitions and the requirements in IFRS 9 and consistent with the mechanics for calculating interest on credit impaired financial assets. The requirements in IFRS 9 do not allow for the difference between interest calculated on the gross carrying amount and interest calculated on the amortized cost to be recognized in profit or loss as interest revenue. So any reversals thereof cannot be recognized in profit or loss as interest revenue. Question 1 on page 16 of the paper asks whether the committee agrees with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS 9 set out in paragraphs 27 to 54 of the paper. So we apologize for the incorrect paragraph references that were mentioned in question 1. Mm-hmm.
Okay. No cards up, so just all happy. Good. Tony?
Yeah, I agree with the staff's conclusion. I think there are two things going on. If you accrete interest into the gross carrying amount, then there has to be a corresponding entry, effectively, that writes it off because it's credit impaired, and because IFRS 9 is clear about where things go. Those two things are happening on the impairment line, so when you reverse, when it's cured, the reversal has to go through the impairment line. So, yeah, I think I agree with the staff's conclusion and the logic for getting there.
Can I just quickly... Tony, you also had, when we were discussing earlier, you had some thoughts on how we can and do the TAD better. Do let us know so that we can work on that.
I was saving it for when we talk about the agenda decision, but it's written in quite dense financial instruments speak. I'm not sure how easy it will be to follow, and I haven't yet had a chance to think about it, but it's not the easiest agenda decision to follow, I think, that we've ever written.
I think one question is how much we need to get into the overtime accounting as opposed to the unwind accounting, if you like. Bob?
I also support the staff in this. To be honest, I think I can see the basis for the second view, but I think the staff brings out why the first view is the better view. I also think it narrows practice. I also think it's more practical.
Yeah.
So I support the agenda decision.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks. I'm kind of in a bit of a mixed view on this, and I'll tell you why. I can see where the staff get to, and I mean, I can accept that if I had to do a preference, I'd probably say I do prefer view one. There is a however, and the however is that in our jurisdiction, this is a major issue in terms of how the banks are reporting. They are not reading it as clear-cut as that. They're saying that, look, whether you think view one or view two is the correct one, they're saying they believe we need further guidance on that, and they're saying that the guidance is not currently, there's not enough in IFRS 9 to get you there. So they're saying, so the view that's being expressed at the moment to us is saying, look, guys, we accept that we don't think the stand's clear enough, which is why they currently view it at the moment as there'd be a choice between where you'd report that. And if we believe that we do want it into view one, they strongly believe that it would result, that standard setting is required. This is not an agenda decision.
One thing I personally don't understand in the view two accounting, which would end up, based on the numbers in the paper, with a credit of interest of 13 at the date that you actually managed to recover in full, is how you get a credit to interest of 13 as a lump item in an interest revenue line item for something that's measured at amortized cost, which is an overtime mechanic.
I guess part of the problem with this, really, if you kind of, well, when I take a look at it, is it's this whole issue of kind of of the guidance that we've currently got is around what happens when you've got this unrecognized interest and how that comes back, and the fact that there just isn't a lot of guidance on that at the moment. So we're kind of in a situation where we need to try and find a way to bring that back. Now, I think view one gives me the better answer, intuitively. If I read the question, I got there, I get there. But I'm saying I can see sympathy in view two and saying that I don't think that is there enough in IFRS 9 that says to me, hang on, you have to do it like it. This is the only option that currently exists, and this is the piece of guidance that tells me how you would do that. Well, we're kind of analogizing with a crowbar to a degree to say, look, it sounds like it's the right answer, therefore we're going to get there, but is there enough in the standard to force me to do that?
Andrew?
I also agree with the staff view. And one of the things that I did is I walked my way through the agenda paper and pieced my way through the agenda decision, and we'll come back to it in the agenda decision in a minute, is just to look at how the different elements can be pieced together so that there's a clear picture of why you end up in the answer. So if I look at paragraph 41, for example, I think the point made in paragraph 41 of the paper is right. But you could go a bit further and say, well, if 541B says you can only recognize interest income on the amortized cost, that effectively saying you can't recognize any more than that. And so that was one element which, to my mind, persuaded me that it wasn't just that when I'm recognizing interest, I recognize it on the net amount. It is that that excess bit can't go through as a credit of some other kind as well, because I'd effectively be recognizing some other form of interest, which 9 tells me not to do. So there's maybe a little bit of piecing and seeing if there's a stronger hook to get together on that point. The other thing that I think was raised elsewhere in the submission was a reference to paragraph BC575, where they talked about the unwinding of discount only affecting the calculation and presentation of revenue, interest revenue, and not the measurement of the loss allowance. And sitting thinking about that, that made me think that what you're looking at there is a measurement of the loss allowance as charged in the income statement. And so what it's telling you is you've got a zero effect on the loss allowance in the income statement, which is entirely consistent with where the staff analysis have gone. So I do understand where the staff have gone on this. I find it very difficult to go somewhere else. I think we could just piece the little bits of the puzzle together a little more clearly.
So I too agree with the roadmap through the standard that's laid out in the paper, and that seems to be the requirement of IFRS 9. So I no disagreement with where the staff has got to on this. I would observe, though, the person on the street type test to the result here. It's not terribly intuitive. If you think about a loan where I ultimately collect all the principal and all the interest, and I'm portraying that as, interest income of something less and negative impairment. The answer is not intuitive to a person on the street, but I think the answer in the staff paper is where IFRS 9 seems to clearly take you.
Cora?
Yeah. I completely agree with that the staff analysis and view. And first of all, I do not think that the accounting policy choice should be permitted, the case like this. If the view to allows that the interest income be due to the pure curement of stage three loans, that will, I'm afraid, that inflate or exaggerate revenue, interest revenue. And this is, I believe, a kind of one-time gain. And from the next, year, that this portion will decrease. And so that it will distort that the net interest income, which is a very important, performance measure for the banks. And also that it may not be that the accounting standards role, but from the financial stability point of view, that the comparability of these treatments are very, very essential. And so I believe that, view one would provide a better picture, first of all, the better picture of the economic reality of that entity. And the second, that from the comparability of the user's point of view, that I prefer that the view one.
And I think, just consistent with your analysis, Gary, that was what the design was, because the design's really saying that because of the net presentation, you're saying I'm actually increasing my loss allowance to reflect the fact I don't think I'm going to get the interest on this instrument. So that's why I've reduced the interest revenue line item.
Yeah.
When suddenly a miracle happens and it goes from stage three to being repaid in full, that's a credit recovery event.
Yeah.
An impairment line item, it's not, I've earned interest over time. That's the logic. Michael?
So on this paper, I must confess, I started off with the counterintuitive response that the reverse of the impairment wouldn't be more than the impairment. But on reading the paper and working through it, and discussing with my colleagues, I think we agree with the staff analysis as well that, the definition of gross carrying amount and impairment and such like, they are what they are, and that drives you to view one. Peeking ahead slightly, there may be an issue about distortion and disclosure and making sure that everything is clear to the person on the street or whoever about your net interest margin, but I think the technical answer is correct. We would agree with that.
Thank you. Young Su?
I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. However, I do have a trouble on the term unrecognized interest. When I first looked at it, I thought that's an interest we do not recognize.
Yeah.
But what we are saying is that we are recognized, but not as an interest.
No, we'll take care of that.
I think Tony says something about that. But I suggest to change the wording of it, unwinding of interest, and also it results in allowance, loss of allowance. But maybe we have to combine both of those two. Like, for example, the unwinding of interest on allowance, loss of allowance. That might be a better expression for that unrecognized interest. And the second point I want to make is that this agenda decision was so difficult to understand. I'm not from accounting firm. As somebody said, when I read through the staff paper, the paragraph 40 and 41 really helped me understanding, this agenda decision as well as whole staff paper. So somehow, I suggest you to include paragraph 40 and 41 summarized of it into some part of the agenda decision, then people will be able to understand the agenda decision much easier.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Reinhardt?
So I agree with the staff agenda decision with the logic of the agenda decision. I think the way I was thinking of it is while the asset is credit impaired, effectively interest is being recognized on a credit adjusted interest rate. And so at the point in time where it moves out of being credit impaired and you that catch-up adjustment, I think, is clear from 558 of IFRS 9, needs to go through the ECL line. And I think, as you said, Sue, recognizing some additional interest in the interest income line would not be consistent with the definition of amortized cost, et cetera. So I think, as others have said, there are ways we can simplify the agenda decision to make it easier to read. But I do agree with the staff on that basis.
Thanks, Reinhardt. Mary?
I put up my card to respond to Bruce's comment, but there's been some very helpful interventions along the way that have encouraged me to be strong in my response to this comment, which is, I think as a board observer at these meetings, I have to think particularly hard when I hear somebody say, I'm not sure that the standard is as clear as the staff thinks. And I think the thing that is clear is enough to preclude a view two, which is that there is no unrecognized interest. And that goes back, I think, to what Andrew Buchanan said about the paragraph, I can't remember, I didn't note the number down, but where it makes clear that if you are in stage three, the interest is calculated on the amortized cost basis, and that's it. That there isn't a question about that. And when I step back further as a non-FI specialist, I say, this model, one of the important things about the IFRS non-impairment model is not just that it's changing the timing of when you are recognizing impairment losses, but it is actually having recognition and measurement consequences of significant increase in credit risk, so that when so that the model actually has recognition and measurement impacts. And so it's not just about accelerating our estimate of the ultimate outcome. It is about saying that there are consequences for having significant increase in credit risk. And so therefore it makes sense to me that if something, and this simplified fact pattern may be a bit unrealistic to have an entire collection of something that had gotten all the way to stage three, but if you have that scenario, that it's not that now you know the outcome, you go back and true up every line as if you had known this was the outcome from the beginning, but rather you're the accounting reflects kind of the journey that it's had. And I think Andrew pointed to the right paragraph in the paper, which pointed to the right paragraph of IFRS 9 in terms of making clear that for the period you're in stage three, that is the interest recognition model. And I think that is what kills the accounting policy election that's set out in view two, that says there's unrecognized net income that you catch up with, because the model in IFRS 9 is not just an estimate that you true up at the end to what it would have been if you'd known from all along. So I'm comfortable, based on the analysis and the discussion at the table, that there's enough in the standard to make clear that you can't sustain view two and unrecognized interest. And I think we probably have to eliminate that term from the agenda decision, because I think repeating it confuses things.
I actually wonder, even though I'm an IFRS 9 geek and proud of it,
you wear badges.
When you go through this analysis, I can see why there's some benefit in having been involved in the development of the standard to understand how all of the bits fit together. And I actually wonder whether, even if the committee decides that we don't need to do standard setting and we want to move forward and look at a tentative agenda decision, whether we might need, as an organisation, to think about the benefits of some sort of educational material to help people understand better how the mechanics work, to help them put the pieces together, because it's not that intuitive.
I think, Sue, just to come into that, I think one of the challenges that is being seen where we are is that, you know, the intention wasn't to change a lot of what was happening on amortized cost, and the guys are seeing this as a substantial change from us.
Well, that depends on what you were doing before.
Bruce, that's where I would very much come in and say it depends on how you interpreted 39 on what would be the interest recognition, because those were regulatory provisions, not 39 provisions.
Yeah, but they were signed off on, if you know what I'm saying. This is what the guys were doing. I mean,
if I have to start correcting that becomes a bit challenging.
Anyway, moving right along. Okay. So question two on page 17 is whether the committee agrees with the staff's recommendation not to add this to the standard setting agenda. If I could get a show of hands, please.
That is Bruce. All bar one. So 12.
Okay, now moving to the tentative agenda decision, which is relatively complicated, at least in part, due to the subject matter. One thing I did wonder when I read this agenda decision, and I don't know whether this is something to do on the hop or not, if the committee agrees, is that it seemed to me that really the question we're being asked in here is, do we really mean that the reversal has to go through the impairment line item? And for me, then, there's some questions of the mechanics along the way in terms of how you do the debits and credits. And I think there's different ways of thinking about that, because it's not set out in, you know, massive debit and credit type detail, bookkeeping detail in the standard. But the outcomes all land with the same, I think, conclusion in terms of where the reversal goes when you are repaid in full. And I do wonder whether we need to go through all of these debit and credit sort of discussion along the way in the agenda decision, or whether we only needed to comment upon where the reversal is and make the agenda decision more concise. So I guess I'd be interested in a few thoughts on that. Front. Andrew?
I perhaps go back to one of the comments that people made about IAS 39 12 years ago when things fell over, that recognising gross interest income on financial assets that clearly aren't going to give you that interest income doesn't really seem like a very good idea. And I had always thought that that was one of the reasons why, when you get to stage three in IFRS 9, you were restricted to the amortised cost. So you pulled back your interest recognition significantly to reflect the deterioration in credit quality. And I think it might be helpful in the agenda decision to bring a bit of that thought process out, because that then leads you into part of the why, when you've got an asset which subsequently cures, you're not going to recognize that all that interest income as if it hadn't been in stage three. It's going to come back through the impairment line, because that's effectively what you were doing as you went along, that to the extent you had a reduction from gross carrying amount to amortized cost, you only recognized interest income on that amount. The rest of it implicitly was getting wrapped up into the impairment provision through the mechanics of the standard. That then takes me on to the question of, do I think it's helpful to walk people through in a fairly structured way how the standard mechanics work? In fact, it may be, because if we're looking to have this as a bit of educational guidance in IFRS 9, what a number of us, I think, are hearing from constituents in the marketplace is that this is a bit of IFRS 9 that is perhaps a little bit more difficult than others. It may be there are aspects of it that haven't been entirely clear because other things have been up in the lights. This was coming a bit later. So if we can explain this a little bit more, rather in the way, for example, that we did in the IFRS 15 agenda decisions, where we took people by the hand and walked them through what they had to do, that may be quite a helpful thing to do. I'm interested in what others think, but I just think of the comments that I hear back, and also the comments that some have made of, this doesn't look particularly intuitive. So if we're able to explain not just the what, but the how and why, I think that would be a useful thing to do.
So that is why I thought paragraph 40 and 45 was that paper will help people understand. Paragraph 40 and 41 is going to help people understand what this agenda decision is. So that was my suggestion.
I guess the question for me is whether that's better in an agenda decision or whether it's better in educational material, because I think what we can certainly draw out from the standard, which is what the staff have done in the analysis, is that we've got certain anchors that we know are explicitly required. The interest revenue line item has to be calculated on a net basis because you're in stage three. When you get to the recovery at the end, that definitely needs to go through impairment. And we know that along the way, you need to have the gross carrying amount of the asset and the ECL amount both growing for the effect of time value of money, so both of those. And then we also know that if you're doing debits and credits for those interest entries on the other side, that they need to be done on a net basis so that the only effect on P&L is the net interest revenue line item. In terms of the specificity of where the debits and credits go to get that net effect, I think that's where it's not in black and white in the standard. I think it's definitely the case that you don't end up with unrecognised interest that then turns up in an interest revenue line item, but in terms of the sort of bookkeeping mechanics, that's another sort of layer. The only reason.
I just come in. I think coming to what the point Andrew made about why this was done to counteract the counterintuitive thing, and also the mechanics and what happens, Young Soo, I agree, and that's why I also said, Tony, appreciate the TAD is tentative agenda decision is dense, where we got to. I think all of this are more prone to educational because the IFRIC agenda decision is more on the technical side. So if that's the case, I would personally also think we can do that in a lot more elaborate detail without having to be so tightly constrained by things in an educational material rather than in a tentative agenda decision. For that one, especially the history and why we are doing this, that's more akin to that.
What we could do, though, to Andrew's point, to support the... because I think one of the reasons why people are maybe... unclear or confused is this idea that you can have a reversal that's bigger than the amounts that went through P&L. Mm-hmm. But making the point that through this net presentation, you've built an allowance which takes into account the shortfalls in interest as well, and that's reflected in the reversal through P&L, and why that makes sense would maybe be of assistance. Mm-hmm. Marie?
Yes, I agree with your suggestion. I think it's important to do both, to have education material and maybe can also work a bit more on the agenda decision, because the agenda decision is something which are sort of more poor, because something which is a bit more looked at and sort of thing. So if it's only education material, we think it's my bigger problem, especially if it's some jurisdictions that are reluctant to apply that. So I would suggest to do both.
Yeah. Well, I think we would need an agenda decision to at least cover personal point. Bruce?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, that given where the issue is a gender decision, I would have kept it short. And the reason I say this, I personally, I mean, as you know, I'm not convinced it's 100%, and I think the moment we start getting to the mechanics, I'm just going to get more questions. So
it's going to bring in more questions.
That's what I'm saying. I'll just keep it short.
I think that's better for an educational side rather than in a TAD, because we can't go into that level of detail
that's on
the which other options.
It's going to end up as a 5 or 6-page gender decision.
Agree.
Jim?
I tend to like a longer version of the agenda decision, particularly for these new and complicated standards. We need to let the world know how to decipher these wordings and how to do the debits and credits. That's the accountants do at the end of the day. So I don't mind to put them on both the agenda decision and maybe copy it to the educational material once more. It will help. Wherever we could put them in, we know it's clear, and we should let the world know.
Young Soo? Maybe we can add on example to the agenda decision. There is a fact pattern, and there is a result. But what is missing in the staff paper is the journal entries. So if we can show both the fact pattern, journal entries, as well as the results of the fact pattern, and if we attach it onto the agenda decision, it's going to help people understand what we are trying to say in the agenda decision. One thing that I remember is that we have done that in the past. In the past, what we have done was to release only the wordings in the agenda decision, but we put an example in the green book with the agenda decision. So maybe there is one thing we can do for this one.
We will consider it, Young-soo, but what you're saying with an example and other things, it's better to do that through an educational material, because some of the journal entries, you can do net or you can do gross, you can do a number of alternatives. I don't want to specify which path to go because IFRS doesn't. So it's better as an educational material, and as Bruce says, that might open up other questions, I'll confuse the issue, but we fully appreciate that there is a need to explain this better, and which is not maybe some alternative mechanism. Understand where you're coming from, Yang-soo.
Mary?
Yes, I just wanted to reinforce very great degree of caution in terms of incorporating the educational content into the agenda decision. I think, you know, the discussion here has been very helpful at highlighting the kind of information, the kind of questions people have about the mechanics and how it works, and that is material that we should provide. But I think the agenda decision should really focus more on, you know, what responding to the question that was asked, which was, is it permissible to read this in a way that does a catch up, you know, for interest. And I think in the past it has been on an exceptional and very cautious basis that the committee has decided to answer specific fact patterns in some detail, and it really has been when it's only addressing a specific fact pattern that itself was contentious that the committee went as far as doing the detail as opposed to explaining just how you think about approaching the question. And this, to me, doesn't feel like that kind of question. So I don't think it goes to the detail. But I understand entirely and have tremendous sympathy with those who say, if I read the agenda decision, I couldn't sit and scribble out the debits and credits and understand what it is. And so I think then supplementing the agenda decision with some explanatory educational material that could go through, you know, kind of normal development and review, but try and be as timely as possible would be a better approach.
Kumar, so there's two things which I would be suggesting looking at the tentative agenda decision. One is I'm not really that keen on these words unrecognised interest, even though I know that it helps people understand. I don't think from our perspective it is unrecognised interest, and so my preference would be that we look at redrafting the agenda decision to remove that notion. Also, my suggestion would be that we focus on the reversal. So I would be inclined to consider a shorter version of the agenda decision. So if you've got it in front of you, my suggestion would be that we think about removing the things that deal with the accounting along the way, if you like, in the sense. So I'd keep the paragraph that talks about Appendix A and refers to the definitions, because I think those are important.
And then go on to the reversal just from that paragraph, when a financial asset.
And, yeah, refer to the paragraphs 5, 5, 8 and refer to that, and then go on to observe the fact that any reversal of ECL shall be recognised in profit or loss as credit impairment. And maybe think about building in something to observe the fact that for a Stage 3 asset, that means that the amount of the ECL can be greater than what was recognised, at least on a net basis, in P&L, and to confirm that is correct.
What do you mean, yeah.
We'll give it a shot. Yes. And once it's done, we will consider some other educational material.
Yes, and we'll look at educational material for the mechanics.
Mechanics.
Is the committee happy to vote on that basis?
Yeah.
Okay. Show of hands.
Sorry, just one thing. Very. Would you then, up front, we've got the reference to 541B, so that would be kept at the end of the first paragraph.
Yes. Yep.
To make it absolutely clear that when you're in stage three, you're recognising.
We'll make sure that we've got 541B included. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Good
okay,
point.
Fine. Yeah. Sorry.
To make that very clear. Okay. Show of hands for the committee, please.
All in favour?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's take a break now and reconvene at 10 past 1.